So, I want you to start off today by just trying to imagine something for me. Try to imagine you're like 10 years old again.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's taking us back a bit.
Right. And you are trapped. You are sitting there in this immaculately pressed white button-down shirt, just sweating through a incredibly dry Sunday sermon.
Ugh, I can practically feel the stiff collar right now.
Exactly. You're in this church with these perfectly painted pastel walls, and every single time you shift in the pew, you're terrified you're going to ruin your clothes.
Because your reality is just entirely constrained by adult rules at that age,
Right.
right? Rigid schedules, overwhelming boredom.
Yeah, but then the second you step out of those heavy doors, you aren't just a kid walking home anymore. You slip this cinematic fantasy filter right over your neighborhood.
Oh, I love that analogy. A cinematic fantasy filter.
Yeah, I mean, think of it like you become an explorer mapping out unknown, treacherous territories. Like the stray dog down the street, that's a mythical beast.
Right, and the dilapidated house on the corner is suddenly this impenetrable fortress holding ancient secrets.
Exactly. And that is the exact mission of our deep dive today. We are immersing ourselves in the rich, really layered world of a town called Annington.
It is such a fascinating place to look at.
It really is. We have this incredible collection of narrative accounts, and we're going to look closely at how a specific group of young residents navigate change and mystery and just, growing up.
And they do it by employing this breathtakingly elaborate fantasy role-playing game.
They do. And to really grasp the mechanics of what these kids are doing, I want you, the listener, to think back to how you processed complex changes or scary places when you were younger.
Because that's what sets the stage for the psychological layers we're going to uncover today. It's a brilliant strategy to analyze because it reveals so, so much about the human mind.
Right. We're looking at this localized ground-level narrative of kids seamlessly blurring the lines between the mundane reality they're forced to inhabit and the magical world they've constructed.
Yeah, and on the surface, it looks like simple child's play. But when you look closer, you realize they are executing a highly sophisticated psychological coping mechanism.
Built with like astonishing world-building precision.
No, absolutely. The precision is incredible.
So setting the scene in Annington, the physical environment perfectly sets up this tension between the world the adults want and the world the kids are desperately seeking.
It really does. Right off the bat, the sources show us this stark architectural contrast between two churches in
Right, you
town.
have the modern Church of Jesus Christ Redeemer, which is where our story actually begins.
And it is entirely functional. I mean, it has running water, modern indoor plumbing, those pastel walls you
And
mentioned.
that altar, made of a very simple flat slab of black walnut wood.
Exactly. It is the absolute epitome of the modern, predictable, sanitized world.
Which stands in direct opposition to the older church in town, right?
Yeah, the Church of God's Word, which the older residents actually prefer, that older church is full of intricately carved altarpieces and stained glass windows.
It has shadows and texture.
Exactly, it has a sense of history. And that architectural divide does a lot of heavy conceptual lifting here.
How so?
Well, it represents the friction between a thoroughly modern, easily explained reality and an ancient, mysterious one.
Right, and the kids are clearly chafing against that sanitized version of reality. I mean, we meet our core group right after a particularly mundane sermon about guilt.
And they are physically constrained by the adult world in that moment.
Totally. Tom is squirming in those black slacks and his pressed white shirt. Agatha, who is usually, the ultimate tomboy, she's been wrangled into a rare green skirt.
With a white blouse and gold buttons, right? And a gold nylon scarf.
Yeah, she must be so uncomfortable. And even her older brother, Toby, is anchored to the adult world. He's carrying this heavy salesman's pasteboard briefcase filled with woodworking samples.
They are completely trapped in the ordinary. So the moment they are released from that environment, their immediate instinct is to seek out the unknown.
They want to break up that ordinary routine.
Exactly. They want to find the cracks in that sanitized facade. So they walk right past the Sherman Tower, which is this massive, modern edifice of glass and steel.
And they make a beeline for Weber Way to a place called Harcourt Manor.
Harcourt Manor. Just the name sounds imposing.
It really does. It's the quintessential haunted house. It's a grand, decaying Victorian structure. The vines are crawling up the sides so thickly, they actually expose the crumbling brickwork.
And it has those twin heavy oak doors.
with the imposing brass lions, head knockers, holding iron rings in their fangs. I mean, it is practically begging to be explored.
It really is. And what's genuinely profound here is how the kids, specifically Agatha, how they conceptualize the danger or the haunting of this space.
Because she doesn't just think they're cartoon ghosts floating through the halls, does she?
No, not at all. She argues that lots of things can haunt a house besides ghosts. Her theory is that history itself is what haunts a place.
Wow. That's deep for a kid.
Right. She believes that if something traumatic happens in a physical space, like, say, someone being locked away in a room for years, that trauma literally sticks to the floorboards and the walls.
Like it physically changes the atmosphere of the room.
Exactly.
Okay, but let me stop you right there, though, because I see a massive contradiction in the group's dynamic here, specifically with Tom.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, Agatha is theorizing about historical trauma sticking to the walls, but Tom is marching down the street, actively muttering under his breath about how he absolutely does not believe in ghosts or monsters.
Right, he's the rational one.
But is he? Because in the exact same breath, he is completely obsessed with getting inside the manor to find hidden chambers and ancient weapons and old diaries and even dead bodies.
Yeah, he really wants to find a body.
Isn't he just as caught up in the fantasy as the rest of them? Like, if he's so rational, why is he hunting for hidden corpses in a Victorian mansion?
Well, see, that isn't a contradiction so much as it is a different flavor of the exact same coping mechanism.
Okay, unpack that for me.
It speaks volumes about the different ways the human brain processes the unknown. For an inquisitive, hyper-rational kid like Tom, the idea of an ethereal, floating ghost is terrifying.
Because he can't understand it.
Right, it cannot be measured or fought or understood. But physical mysteries, lost money, old diaries, or yes, even hidden bodies. Those are tangible.
They're puzzles to be solved.
Exactly. And physical things can be explored, understood, and ultimately conquered. Fear, as Tom actually says in the accounts, is mainly not knowing.
Oh, wow. So by turning a terrifying haunted house into like an archaeological dig site, he strips the fear away.
Precisely. If it's a ghost, you are powerless against it. But if it's a locked hidden room, you just need to find the right crowbar.
That makes so much sense.
The fantasy they are building around Harcourt Manor gives them a cognitive framework to engage with the scary unknown on their own terms. It provides an illusion of control.
But that illusion of control gets immediately tested, doesn't it? Because they aren't just projecting their imaginations onto an empty abandoned space anymore?
No, the real magic happens when this imaginary framework collides with a very real, very complex adult.
Right, because Harcourt Manor has a new owner. A man named Richard Kooning.
And meeting Richard takes all these abstract ideas about exploring and makes them wonderfully physically tangible.
Richard is essentially a real-world NPC for them, isn't he? Like a non-player character in a video game.
Oh, absolutely. He's a pivotal figure in their mythology. He's this wealthy, retired military man.
And he comes with a greyhound dog named Kuan and a horse named Destra.
Yeah, even the animals' names have this exotic old-world cadence that instantly sparks the kids' imaginations.
He's literally the grizzled veteran in the dusty tavern, handing out gold coins and ominous warnings to low-level adventurers.
That is the perfect way to describe it. He invites them into his partially renovated kitchen, and he serves them snacks.
Banner's crusty bread, sharp cheese, and lemonade, right?
Yep, and then he offers them actual jobs. He's willing to pay them 50 cents a week to pull weeds and clean up the grounds.
He even commissions Toby. He offers to pay him by the piece for crafting Victorian-style wooden light switch covers.
Right, but the interaction shifts from a mundane neighborhood chore arrangement into something much deeper when Tom decides to trust Richard with their actual secrets.
Oh, yeah, because they haven't just been playing pretend. Tom reveals that they found actual artifacts.
Right. They found a pile of rubble in a cave out by the hill, and from that rubble, they extracted physical items.
An old flute, meticulously engraved with a rose and a key and a crescent moon earring.
And this is where Richard's reaction is just so incredibly important.
It completely fascinates me, because most adults in that era would, you know, pat the kids on the head, tell them to stop playing in the dirt, and send them home.
But Richard doesn't do that at all. He treats their findings and their curiosity with deep philosophical respect.
He really does. He gives them a stern warning, telling them, you would be wise to avoid such places.
And then he delivers this incredible line. He says, a foul heart may wear a fair face.
It's so ominous.
It is. He essentially tells them that monsters and ghosts do exist. They just wear human disguises. He validates their worldview, but he grounds it in adult reality.
Because he's speaking from a place of profound real-world trauma.
Right.
The scars of a veteran.
Exactly. He tells them he used to give orders in the military, and sometimes people died because of those orders. He understands exactly what Agatha was theorizing earlier about history haunting a space.
Right, that places hold the power of memories.
Yes. Richard explicitly tells them that to someone who grew up in that manner, ordinary, everyday objects might evoke incredibly powerful memories, some painful, some sweet.
He recognizes that these kids are using their artifacts and their ghost stories to practice dealing with the weight of the past.
Even though he notes they are too young to have truly dealt with profound loss yet.
But of course, they are right on the precipice of dealing with loss.
They really are.
And the narrative tracks this shift perfectly. Because we follow that physical artifact, the engraved flute, away from the dusty, decaying Victorian manor and straight into the pastel green, highly modern bedroom of their friend, Rebecca.
And this is where the core function of their fantasy game evolves. We move away from the physical exploration of a spooky house, and we enter the realm of emotional coping.
Psychological survival, almost. Because they are facing a major life transition. Rebecca is packing up her white and green suitcases.
She's preparing to relocate to a country called Ruritania.
Right. And Ruritania is described as this mountainous, foreign place filled with ancient castles.
And, you know, whether that is the actual name of her destination or just the mythological overlay the kids have applied to whatever European country her family is moving to, the effect is the same.
Sounds like a kingdom straight out of a storybook.
It does. And inside this bedroom, the kids fully slip into their fantasy personas to deal with the departure.
The transformation in that room is absolute. Rebecca is no longer just a frightened middle schooler being dragged across the ocean by her parents. She is Lady Sorceress Nimoy.
Agatha takes on the mantle of Knight Redmayne.
The youngest, Alice, becomes the princess, and Simon is the jester.
And even the mundane objects in the room are transfigured. Rebecca pulls out her father's camera.
This curiously shaped black leather case.
And it is no longer a camera, it is the Opticon. A magical device capable of piercing cunning illusions.
The lore they've built is just so deep. The engraved flute gets woven into this massive tapestry.
Oh, yeah. They theorize that the rose and key engraving means the flute can open arcane locks at places they call the Siege of Stone and Water.
Or the Siege des Anges. They talk about communicating via a trained bird named Ryland of Avar and defending against mysterious creatures called the Dru.
The density of the lore is staggering. They have essentially built an entire mythological ecosystem to support this one girl's move.
Okay, but I have to push back here for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
Because this is the moment where I start to wonder, are we sure they aren't taking this a bit too far?
How do you mean?
Well, from a psychological standpoint, isn't there a severe danger in this? If I'm looking at a kid who is about to leave her entire life, her home, and every friend she has ever known, and she is speaking exclusively in character about arcane locks and sorceresses.
It looks a bit concerning.
Yeah. Isn't this just a massive, unhealthy wall of denial? Is this Lady Sorceress persona just a highly sophisticated shield to avoid processing the terrifying grief of saying goodbye?
It is a completely fair question, and it absolutely looks like avoidance on the surface. And to be clear, Rebecca is experiencing profound anxiety.
Right, she's terrified.
She is. She has a very vulnerable moment where she drops the high fantasy vernacular and admits, I feel like a changeling. I'm leaving for a foreign land, and a stranger comes to take my place in my home.
Oh, wow. That is a stunningly articulate expression of displacement. She feels like her identity is being erased.
Exactly. But I would argue strongly against the idea that this is an unhealthy wall of denial. In fact, cognitive psychology would suggest this is an incredibly healthy adaptive framework.
Okay, walk me through that. How is pretending you have a magical camera healthy when you're actually just terrified of a new school?
It's all about agency. Think about it. When a child is forced to move, they are the passive victims of an adult decision. They have zero control over what's happening to them.
Right, they just have to pack their bags and go.
But by reframing this terrifying, out-of-her-control international move as a noble, high-stakes quest to find the king, Rebecca reclaims her agency.
Ah, I see. She's no longer being dragged away. She is departing on a vital reconnaissance mission for her royal court.
Yes. So the Opticon isn't just to take tourist photos to remember her trip. It's a tool so she doesn't miss clues.
It gives her a job to do. It turns her anxiety into excitement.
Exactly. It gives her a purpose. And crucially, it preserves her social bonds across physical distance.
Oh, because they're all still playing the game.
Right. She commands Knight Redmayne to protect the princess and to continue searching Harcourt Manor while she is gone. The game ensures that even when she is thousands of miles away in the mountains of Ruritania, she is still an active, essential part of their daily lives.
That reframing is incredibly powerful. And that exact same mechanism, that cognitive reframing, it doesn't just help the person leaving.
No, it becomes a vital tool for the kids who are left behind as well.
Which we see play out during the climax of this narrative.
Yeah.
As the sorceress departs, we move to the day of departure, down at the bus stop in front of Mrs. Pimpernella's boarding house.
And the contrast in this sequence is just masterful. You have the high fantasy emotional stakes colliding with the most mundane slice of Americana imaginable.
It is so vivid. It's a sweltering, oppressive summer afternoon. Mrs. Pimpernella's boarding house is this dilapidated, two-story wooden building that looks like a prop from a Western ghost town.
And the air smells heavily of roast beef, right?
Yeah, roast beef in the sweltering heat. And then the Greyhound bus arrives. And the driver, who is just a sweaty guy in a uniform, immediately hops out to grab a frosty Coke from Jim's Fishing and Sports Shop down the street.
It is perfectly, boringly ordinary. The mundane reality is just stark.
And against that intensely ordinary backdrop, the emotional goodbye happens. Rebecca's parents, the Trattisons, are anxiously fussing over her luggage and handing out powdered lemon drop cookies.
The tears are flowing, the bus driver honks his horn, and the sorceress departs on her chariot.
But as the bus pulls away, it leaves a new passenger standing on the sidewalk. The changeling Rebecca feared has actually arrived.
Yes. Belinor di Straniero steps off the bus.
And to these kids in small town Annieton, she might as well have dropped in from another dimension.
She really is the absolute embodiment of the unknown.
She has striking porcelain skin and raven black hair that flows all the way down to her waist. She is wearing a brown pleated suit jacket and skirt, which is completely impractical in the sweltering heat.
And she is traveling with this massive, ridiculously heavy wooden brass leather trunk.
That literally has to be physically hauled out of the bottom storage of the bus. She is suddenly standing on their familiar sidewalk. The kids are staring at her. Tom's jaw is physically dropped.
Because she is visibly lost, she looks bewildered, and she is clearly struggling with the language.
So this is the critical juncture. How do children who have just lost their friend handle this sudden alien intrusion into their safe, established world?
To make or break moment.
And the way they handle it is my favorite part of the entire account. Alice, the youngest of the group, steps up. She walks over to this bewildered, overdressed stranger, reaches into Mrs. Travison's basket, and offers Eleanor one of the powdered lemon cookies.
And what she says is just brilliant.
She says, entirely matter-of-factly, "Ravens like cookies." And they say, "Thank you. You remind me of a raven."
It's amazing.
It is exactly like leaving a snack out to tame a startled exotic bird.
It's a charming moment, but underneath the charm, it is a demonstration of pure cognitive genius. This is where we see the fantasy game functioning as an empathy engine.
An empathy engine. Okay, break down the mechanics of that for me. How does pretending she's a raven generate empathy?
Well, think about what happens when you encounter a completely foreign variable. Like a stranger who dresses differently, doesn't understand your inside jokes, and speaks with a heavy accent.
Your brain experiences a spike in cognitive load. It's stressful.
Exactly. It is stressful to interact with the unpredictable, but they don't retreat. Alice immediately looks at Eleanor, sees the raven black hair, and maps her onto their existing mythology.
She assigns her a role. She names her Lady Ravana of Ruritania, the ambassador.
Yes. So by giving her a title, they bypass the stress of the unknown, they instantly hand her a script, and they give themselves a set of rules for how to interact with her.
Oh, I see. They cast her in a role that actually accommodates her strangeness.
Precisely. It makes her weird clothes and her foreign accent a feature of her character, not a terrifying bug. By pulling Eleanor into the lore of their game, they completely neutralize the anxiety of the unknown stranger.
Give her a place of high honor within their social hierarchy before they even really know her name.
And you can see the tension just evaporate.
Totally. Tom, Simon, Agatha, Alice, they all immediately rally around this massive brass trunk. They offer her a Coke from the fishing shop.
And they immediately start trying to figure out how Lady Ravana's character fits into the ongoing epic story of Annieton.
It's incredible to witness. And that is the true magic of what these kids have accomplished, isn't it?
It really is. They prove unequivocally that play and imagination are not simply retreats from reality. They are not distractions or walls of denial.
They are vital, highly sophisticated laboratories for processing reality.
Exactly. They take an abandoned, rotting Victorian house and turn it into a grand restoration project to process historical trauma.
They take the terrifying, uncontrollable reality of a friend moving across the world and reframe it into a heroic, purpose-driven, magical quest.
And they take a nervous, entirely foreign stranger and instantly transform her into a royal ambassador.
Turning fear into welcoming empathy. It's just beautiful.
And before we dismiss this as something unique to childhood, it is crucial to recognize that adults utilize this exact same cognitive machinery every single day.
Oh, we absolutely do.
Think about it. Every time you start a stressful new job and you mentally cast your coworkers as different character archetypes just to understand the chaotic office dynamics.
Oh, I've definitely done that.
Right. Or every time you reframe a daunting cross-country move as a new chapter or an adventure rather than a terrifying uprooting of your life.
You're doing exactly what the kids in Annington are doing. You're creating a manageable mental framework to navigate a challenging, unknown situation.
The stakes change, but the mechanism remains exactly the same.
We all need a cinematic filter sometimes just to get through the day without being overwhelmed.
We really do.
Which leaves you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over today as you look at your own environment. If a stranger were to secretly observe your daily routines, the specific words you use to describe your challenges, and the little jokes you make to get yourself through a stressful week,
what kind of mythology or fantasy game would they assume you are playing to cope with the unknown?
Are you slaying dragons in the boardroom or mapping ruins in your own backyard? Keep exploring.